All right, good morning, everyone. And thank you for listening to the Georgia Prison News weekly radio show. So we had a few technical difficulties this morning. I was trying to do the show live on Facebook and trying something new this morning, and it didn't work out too well. So I apologize for that. So we'll briefly have Susan Sparks with us this morning to kind of go over everything that has transpired this week in the Department of Corrections and kind of just give everyone an update on what we know, what we've learned, and kind of go from there. Like I said, running about 5 or 10 minutes late this morning. And I'm trying to get Susan here, so please just excuse me for just a second on the delay that we're having, because like I said, you know, we have just a few technical difficulties this morning trying to get everything in, so I'll get everything started. But we'll be going over, as I said, the numbers for this week with COVID-19. Been going over some Eighth Amendment violations, how to recognize those violations, what to expect or whatnot, and you know, just a few things that I've observed this week. And I'm sure Susan will have a few things that she's observed as well. So we'll be starting the show very briefly, waiting on Susan to call in. For everyone that's, I see a few people that's in the queue. If you want to join us this morning, if you would press 1, I know that you can call in and listen to the show. You can call in at 516-387-1865. You can call in and you can listen to the show that way. And if you want to join us, press the number 1, and it will give me a it'll give me a alert to the screen, and I can bring you in to talk or to make a comment that way. At this time, I think Susan is with me. Susan, are you with me?
Yes, sir, I am.
Hey, so that way did not work out too well at the last moment. I didn't see a way that I could add you to the video. Well, I did see a way that I could add you for the video, but I never saw you come on the screen. So I think we'll have to play with that some more for next week.
Okay. Well, we'll give it a dry run this next week, see if we figure it out.
Yeah, I think it may be a little bit better way, but how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. Looking forward to the subjects we've got teed up for today. I think we've got a really meaty show today. Lots of really important information.
Absolutely. So, and as I was just saying, if you want to call in, the number to call in is 516-387-1865. Again, that number is 516-387-1865. If you call in, I see a couple people right now that's already in the queue. You can press the one key if you would like to comment on the show, and it'll send me an alert, and I'll get you right in. Susan, but let's start with the latest information on the numbers that we have. I know that you've been keeping record of those numbers, and there's been some trouble in information that you've learned and that you've posted last 24 to 48 hours. So why don't you fill the listeners in on what you've uncovered thus far?
All right. I have been tracking this information, the information the GDC posts each day. And yesterday at 6 o'clock, when they posted the update, it was the worst day yet. And by not just in numbers, but in magnitude. Now remember, the staff is self-reporting their illnesses. The numbers on the inmates are confirmed cases. They have been tested. On the staff, they went in one day from 100 positive to 125 positive, a 25% increase in a single day. Inmates went from 307 to 346 in a single day, and that is 12.7% increase. What we know about the increases from the inmates is there are many more who are not reflected here. They either haven't been tested or they may be in the hospital. We don't have any visibility to that other than the anecdotal information on which prisons have emptied out dorms, moved people to the gym floor, that sort of thing. The facilities that had increases yesterday, I'll start with the inmates, which is probably why most of us come here. GDCP, yesterday, Coastal, 10 inmates. Now, at Coastal, that brings them up to 35 inmates there and no staff. Macon State added yesterday, and five other prisons added one. Bainbridge, five staff. Calhoun and Phillips each added three staff. I hope that we hear from Department of Corrections that transfers are put off. I hope that they will, you know, delay the transfers another week based on the graph that I posted last night on Georgia Prison News, as well as on They Have No Voice. There's a graph called Flatten the Curve. If you remember in the beginning of this, they were talking about we need to flatten the curve. Well, the inmate curve has a trajectory straight up. There's nothing flat about it. It was the worst day yet.
Right, and Susan, let me give this. I think it's important to give just a little bit of background on what I've learned thus far, and I'll bring you in. And Susan, also, your phone was breaking up in between that, so I did get most of it, and I got the point, but you might want to move to a better area while I'm going to kind of jump in. But so just to give of what I've learned, and this comes from a source within the Department of Corrections on the medical side of things. So from my understanding is what takes place is once a prisoner or once someone complains about symptoms of COVID-19, they are tested. I guess they have to have a fever and they have to have some really awful symptoms in order for them to even be tested for COVID-19. But from my understanding, once they test them, the test results can be from 7 to 10 days. Once those
once they've tested. So do you think that that's possibly a the reason why the numbers continue to go up is because how long it's taken to get those test results back?
I do think that's a great factor in it, yes. If GDC chose to do so, they could tell us how many tests were pending, but they have chosen not to tell us that. That would be very helpful to know. Like from yesterday, we've got almost 350 people confirmed with illness, but we still have 100 or 200, whatever that number is, test results pending. That would help us.
Right. I agree with you 100%. Do we know, and I guess we don't know, Susan, I guess that's kind of a crazy question I was about to ask, but I guess we can only kind of speculate on the age of these prisoners, and we don't even know how many are actually in the hospital. I know, I think I reported earlier this week that Ware State Prison had, I think, two or three in the hospital, and those two or three, I think only two of them were COVID-19 related, and then one of them was something that was non-related. But do we know or have we heard on how many are actually in hospitals receiving treatment from COVID-19?
I have not heard any numbers on that, not from any facility.
Okay. What else do we know or have we learned from this week, Susan, that we think the listeners need to know from a COVID-19 standpoint?
Several things did happen this week, although the GDC reversed its decision about transfers. They did, in most of the facilities, go back to the chow hall. So movement has picked up on the campuses. And a number of work details have gone back to work. So we're back out into the community. We don't have any visibility from where we are as to how much of this increase can be attributed to more movement, because we're only 5 days into going back to the chow hall and going back to work details. A few of the work details never stopped, but others did. And there are any number of concerns around the work details at the TCs because of them not having food, you know, not having money coming in for food and so forth.
Right. And I've also heard a few incidents where the TC has actually stopped, or a few TCs were in the beginning allowing family members and loved ones to send them food packages in from them, and I've heard now that they've actually stopped the residents from actually sending in family members or whatnot, sending in any type of packages, and they're moving to a list where they have to order items from a list from from a local prison or whatnot. So that's become just a money making a venture for the TC residents having to order store from that package or from that list now, so they can make some money off of the residents that way.
You know, we've all been to visitation and taken our $20 in quarters or whatever. And, you know, every week when my son was in and I would visit, I might come home with $6, but eating out of the vending machines is very expensive. And a lot of the TCs have vending machines. In the beginning of this pandemic, the vending machines in several facilities were empty for several days, and that was when they were still going to work. Then they'd come home, come back, the residents would come back to the TC, and the vending machines would be empty. So not being able to receive packages from family, and that's been 2 weeks now on that, it combined with having to use the vending machines and having to order store, we're poking the bear in many respects here. I've maintained what I've learned from our experience with the prison system is this thing is a pressure cooker under the best of circumstances. And with this particular situation, with people getting sick, with inmates not being kept in the loop as far as information flow, I'm very concerned what this will be like when some of the restrictions are lifted. But different story for a different day, and when that happens, we'll be talking about it.
Right. Well, and we've already seen this. The ninth or tenth? This is what, death number 10, death number 9? Which, and help me out here.
I believe it is 10.
10. So we've seen our 10th death this week. Give us a little information on that, Susan, if you know it, on the facility. What, I think it was Baldwin, maybe?
Baldwin. It was at Baldwin, and as most people who read the press releases have noticed, GDC reports every time that this was someone who had underlying medical conditions. Well, jeepers, if they have underlying medical conditions, shouldn't they have been protected first? call me crazy. But yes, this was the 10th person, and as best I know, most of these people who have passed, most were in their 60s, but there, I believe there's been one in his 40s. And then, of course, the one staff member, Deputy Warden, at Autry, maybe? I think it was at Autry. Who passed away, but he is the only death among the staff.
Yeah, that one staff member death was at Calhoun State Prison.
Calhoun, yes. He was deputy warden there, though.
Right. So, you know, Susan, I guess, I guess what we've learned this weekend and another thing on this COVID-19, and I think what people are now finally starting to realize and to understand is, that and what I've been saying on this show for the last 2 or 3 weeks, or from our first show, is the numbers are rising because we know now that as everyone knows, is that staff cases are self-reporting, and if they don't report, then there's nothing that anyone can do. And there was an officer that actually, I guess he's a former officer now. That left a comment on one of the pages earlier this week. I think it may have been Sunday or Monday, but left a message that was that it was their bodies and they could report it if they wanted to. That's what you're dealing with when it comes to this. There was one officer, and I can't remember her name right now, but there was one officer that actually agreed. But, she cited that there was, that they just couldn't get tested, that most officers wanted to get tested, but they couldn't get tested unless they had some severe symptoms of the virus. So, I think what people are starting to realize now, Susan, and I would hope that the Department of Corrections will go ahead and make it mandatory that they test all their staff and their officers, and they cut this foolishness, self-reporting stuff out. If they're serious, about getting to the root of the problem and probably stopping this spread. What do you think?
I absolutely agree. Now, the Federal Bureau of Prisons is light years ahead of the state departments of correction. Great information coming out of Marion, Ohio this week. Not great as far as being good, but meaty, informative database information. At Marion, everyone now has been tested, and the test results were right now 86% of the people there, staff and inmates, have had this illness. Many had no symptoms at all, yet they were contagious. And that's the fallacy in the self-reporting, that they may have it and not even recognize that they're sick. They don't have any symptoms, and yet they're making other people sick. And they may go 2 weeks making other people sick before they get sick themselves, if they get sick. But again,
right,
I read yesterday, Marion federal facility, 86%.
Right, Susan, and like I said, you know, if the Department of Corrections are serious, and I think that's a call that we need to start. We need to renew the call from with our social media platforms, because believe me and trust me, they read our comments, they read our information that we put out there. Believe it or not, and I hate to say it, and they have spies possibly in all these groups, and so they know what's going on that forefront. But I think, Susan, we have to continue to push this no transfer thing. We have to continue to push for these officers to be tested, that it be mandatory that they test these officers and they test these staff. And that, you know, we have to continue to use our platforms as best as we can to get this information out, and to hopefully for them to start this stuff. Because I mean, I don't know if they're even serious at this point. I think we're two months in, almost 2.5 months in, and they're still self-reporting, and the numbers are rising. And you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist at this point to figure out the problem and to try to stop this.
Well, I'll say, for they have no voice, I will absolutely draft a letter and send it. I'll email a letter to Department of Corrections on behalf of they have no voice. And I will put the text of that letter in my group, and of course I'll email it to you, Joshua, too. But I think you're right. We need to call again for no transfers for officer or entire staff mandatory testing, a renewal of the commitment to provide soap and hand washing and masks, I'd like to see them. I don't like the idea of everybody getting pack outs every day, but having everyone go into the chow hall is a lot of movement in a big prison. And
right.
One thing in smaller facilities, but the state prisons for the most part are 1,000. Blend up.
And I've learned too, Susan, and just a few weeks ago, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago now, there was a question asked, some prisoners asked a question because they were still going to the trial hall. They were piling at different institutions, and I can't remember the institutions, so I won't say which institutions. But just a few weeks ago, They were still piling prisoners into chow halls around the state. They were not practicing any type of social distancing whatsoever, not following CDC guidelines on social distancing. They were piling people in chow halls and rushing them in and rushing them out so they could feed the entire facility. So, you know, we need to put it out there that every facility is not following these rules, and they're still pushing people out into the chow halls and, you know, crowding them as fast as they can. And they're not, so that, you know, they're not practicing any social distancing whatsoever at some of these facilities. I think that needs to be put out there as well, Susan.
I completely agree. There are two facilities, one male facility and one female. I think Dodge is the male facility. The female, I believe, is Emmanuel. But they did the social distancing. They took every other chair out of the chow hall. They did that in the very beginning. Their wardens had everyone cleaning. The wardens, deputy wardens, were there all day, every day, weekends as well. And what do you know? They've had no cases. And you got to give kudos to those particular wardens because they did right things. They did prepare. They did clean. They were doing daily sanitizing of the common surfaces that people touch, like stair rails and door handles and that sort of thing. And I don't know if that is still going on. Now, I have heard in the last couple of days that a second round of fumigating has begun. I had made an open records request last week for the chemicals, and it does turn out to be that the what they were spraying with was ionized hydrogen peroxide, and there is one of the chemicals, that the one that smells like a disinfectant, also has something called quaternary ammonium in with it. So that was the one that we were hearing people call the corona killer, and only a couple of facilities used it. That was what they were using. So the spraying has begun. I know last Friday, not yesterday, the week before, GDC reported that they had completed the spraying of all the facilities, but I don't think that was complete. Some of the holes didn't get cleaned at all. And,
right, and let's say that's horseshit. And excuse my expression there, Susan, but and I didn't mean to cut you off, and I'll let you come back in just a second. But I wanted to touch on that because if I don't, I'll forget. So we believe that they went to 90 facilities, which they said they were going to do, and we discussed it on this show. I think they had already did about 14 2 weeks ago when we talked about it on the show. Because the way I found out about it is they actually tweeted some images of some people, if you remember, in some type of hazmat suit, spraying some unknown chemical, which we know what it is now because you just said it. But at any rate, we know now that supposedly they were going to go to all 90 facilities. Well, Susan, and you have to stop, and you got to let the listeners understand why you can't always take the Department of Corrections at face value. And before I say that, let me stop, because Susan, you just did give kudos to the Department of Corrections, to two wardens just a second ago, which we probably never done on this show, but we're supposed to take them at face value, and we know for facts that at least I can count five or six facilities that we know has been on lockdown for maybe 3 or 4 or 5 weeks. I mean, Macon State stayed on lockdown almost 7 weeks, Susan. So we know that they haven't been to some of those facilities and sprayed. So or sanitize or anything like that. So because we know that GSP, Telfair, like I said, Macon State has been on long periods of time of lockdown. So we know that they just not have been to every facility.
You know, I'm not going to laugh at this, but I'm going to say it's probably preposterous to think that a team of people in hazmat suits managed to get to 90 facilities. These are big places. The little ones, the county camps aren't, but the big state prisons, they're big. And 90 of them?
So you want us to believe that these groups of people are going? I mean, first of all, they don't. And from my understanding, Susan, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're free to definitely correct me anytime I'm wrong on this show. But from my understanding, these are not even actual hazmat crew. They don't have any special training or anything like that. I mean, these are officers and staff members made up of different facilities that they're working overtime. And our listeners, if you've been paying attention, you've noticed, or if you're on social media, which I'm sure most of you are, and you see the tweets and the Facebook posts that they've been encouraging and thanking their staff this week for their tireless efforts and their working so much overtime and whatnot and to keep these facilities safe. And they actually even this week for the first time in a long time threw out some contraband photos and things that they had found on at these facilities, which I mean, Susan, I mean, you know, there's not been anybody going to these facilities for visitation or whatnot. So I mean, that stuff has to be coming from somewhere, and there's not many people going on these grounds right now. So you know, you can read between the lines of that if you want to. But you know, like I said, they've been giving out this week all over social media, just thanking their staff for the excellent job that they're doing. And you know, like I said, getting back on topic here, these people are not certified. They're not. They don't have any special training to be going around and doing all this stuff. You know, so like you just said, do we really actually supposed to believe that they've been to all 90? Facilities and has sanitized those facilities? I don't think so.
No. I thought preposterous was the right word.
You know, but, you know, so that's why, like I said, guys, and to all our listeners that's listening to this show this morning who will go back and listen to the show later on, you know, you can't take this department at face value. That's why we're here to kind of to go behind them and to fact check and, you know, let you guys really know what's going on, because, you know, sometimes that's just not the case. So switching gears, there was some more troubling news that we learned this week. And I'll let you start on the kennel death at, I think, Rutledge State Prison. And then I'll touch on the Eddie Gozer death at Augusta State Medical Prison. So it's yours right now. Go ahead.
Okay. On Monday night, someone got in touch with me, someone from Rutledge, got in touch with me and gave me the information on the death of an inmate, James Mitchell, at Rutledge. And inmate Mitchell had been put in the kennels or the cages at 6:10 a.m. that morning. And it was a very warm, sunny day that day. And at 6:10 p.m. that night, he was dead. I had never seen, I'm new to this. I'd never seen the cages or the kennels, but apparently they exist at almost every one of the state, the big prisons. There's nothing like that at the county camp, but at the big prisons, my understanding is almost all of them have them, even Lee Arendelle has them, and that they are used, they're purportedly used for an exercise yard for people who are in protective custody or in the hole for punishment or so forth. But in the particular case, they were used as punishment instead of giving someone a DR. And I was also sometimes with the mental health inmates, they use those when they've had some type of meltdown. And it's sort of like a place for time out. But in this, you know, we are in the Deep South. And I was horrified to see those pictures. They appear to be in the pictures, and there's not much to tell. And someone else, I'm sure, knows exactly what the dimensions are. They appear to be maybe 8 feet wide, 20 feet long, something like that, chain link, very tall chain link, and then tons of razor wire across the top. The man who told me about it told me he gave inmate Mitchell water twice that day, and he received somewhere between 24 and 30 fluid ounces of water. Well, 32 fluid ounces of water is a quart in the course of 12 hours. I've asked for the incident report on inmate Mitchell's death, but it's just a horrifying death to me. And if this turns out to be truthful, and the man who told me about it had no reason to lie to me about it or to make it up out of whole cloth, I think that it shows that promoting from within allows people to the people in charge to turn a blind eye what's right before their face. That they have cages they're putting people in, and it seems to me that it is clearly torture if it's hot enough to die from it and you have no fluid, no restroom, no food. I don't know, horrifying.
But all right, Susan, and let me jump in here on this one before we get to Mr. Gozer, because we have a little time here to kind of time to dive into this real quick. And let me give the number out, 516-387-1865. If you want to call in and give your thoughts, comments, or whatever, feel free to do so. If you call in, we do have some people in the queue that's just listening. If you want to call in and talk to us, press the 1 button. I'll get alert on the screen, and I'll bring you in. Again, the number is 516-387-1865, talking to Susan Sparks about just what's been going on this week inside of the Department of Corrections. Susan, but want to dive in real quick and give the listeners an ideal on why people go to those cages. So, and being formerly incarcerated, being inside of the Georgia prison system formerly, I know a little bit about why someone would be in those cages. So let's back up and let's give the listeners just a little bit of a backdrop. Okay, so Susan, about 6 o'clock, you said that was about the time that person was in the cage, around 6 a.m. or a little after.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Okay, so normally at that time of the morning, it's normally either shift change or someone has been in the cage for whatever, they're put in that cage for whatever reason. All right, so normally, Susan, and to the listeners, when you go into that cage that early in the morning, that's probably because you're going to you're going to the hole. They have no bed space at that time in the hole, so they will put you in the either one or two places, either in that cage or in the shower, until they can clean out the hole and find bed space for you to go into the hole. What I know is, from experience, I worked in the hole at one time, and I know that when you go into that cage, you can be in that cage anywhere between an hour to 12 hours. They'll feed you in that cage. They'll feed you in the shower. They'll feed you. You will be lucky to get water, because most of the time they put you in a cage and they'll forget about you, and you'll get two or three neighbors beside you throughout the day. People will refuse housing, or they'll lock somebody up. That phrase "lock somebody up" means that, you know, for whatever reason, the administration has decided to send someone to the hole, and they'll put you in the hole, and they won't have bed space, so they'll put you in the cage. As I said, you can stay in that cage from an hour to 12 hours. And it's completely cruel. I've seen people, poop in those cages, urinate in those cages, throw up in those cages. I mean, whatever the case is, and to me, it's just a death trap. You're outside, but you got to remember, and like Susan just said, in the summertime, 100 and whatever degree temperature with no water, locked in that little bitty small place, it's a death trap. So when I saw this, and I do remember this week it was hot. It was almost 80, 90 degrees some days this week, even though now it's kind of chilly. It's a real death trap. And when I saw the news on this, I wasn't surprised. And honestly, I can't believe that it hasn't been more deaths by these practices, because you see it all the time where they put people in showers for. I've heard of stories of people been left in showers for 2 days, just to prove a point. And Susan, I don't know if you remember, even a few back in about 2 years ago, maybe a little less than that, the AJC actually. Did a story on officers on social media actually joking about going to work and leaving people in the showers for days and days at a time. And the sad thing about it is it actually wasn't a joke. They actually do things like this, and we've seen that now by the death this week of Mr. Mitchell at Rutledge State Prison, which is horrible. And I think that the Georgia Department of Corrections, there's where we have to use our voice again. Another senseless death of someone being left in a cage, just left to die in a cage for over 12 hours. And, what will we hear this time from the Department of Corrections, if we hear anything at all? But, it's a senseless death, Susan.
Absolutely. I understand the intention of this, but this, to use it as punishment or to put someone out there without rigorously enforced procedures as to fluid intake and restroom breaks, that sort of thing, is absolutely cruel and unjust. And that will take us at some point to the Eighth Amendment. So we'll keep this in mind. It's the Department of Corrections' job to protect even those inmates they don't like. People who may have done horrific things, it's still their job to protect them. They have a First Amendment right to life.
Yeah, and Susan, I mean, it starts at, and I've been saying this for the last few weeks on this show, is that this lack of leadership starts at the top. It starts right at the desk of Timothy Ward, and it trickles down to all of the staff at these facilities and under Timothy Ward. You know, and this stuff has not just started. You know, it's been going on for a long time now. But with this, and what I do think has happened here, and I'll try to be as brief as possible when I make this point. But what I do think has happened here is that this COVID-19 has brought a new light on the prison system here in Georgia, and that, if we can find a blessing out of anything dealing with this COVID-19, is that, you know, it has shed some light on the prison system and things that has transpired in the prison system that, you know, would not be known, you know, if it wasn't for, you know, something like this virus that's going around. You know, and I think that, you know, the various groups that's posting things out there on social media, Georgia Prison News, they have no voice. You know, inside the Georgia Inmate Lives Matter, Georgia, just, you know, I don't want to start naming groups because, you know, I'll get in trouble. Somebody get mad because I didn't name theirs. But, you know, all of the various groups that's posting this information and whatnot, you know, I wish that the media would get involved more, you know, because, you know, that would actually, you know, make it the outcry more, you know, I think it would help that, you know, we get the media involved more and they start reporting on some of this thing, on some of the stuff that's going on. Because, you know, it'll shed the more light on the situation. And I kind of want to jump to, too, Susan, because you alluded to it, too. You know, it is the Department of Corrections, like you said, and I 100% agree with you. It is the Department of Corrections' responsibility to keep every offender safe. And that's just not taking place. And, you know, the listeners know, well I'm going to bring the listeners in on the situation that took place at Augusta State Medical Prison on last Saturday evening. An offender was murdered by a cellmate. And we've come to find out by just a little research that I've done on the situation. You know, his cellmate should have never been in general population. His cellmate should have been on high max in Jackson for a previous murder that took place in 2013. But because of a lapse in the computer or a lapse in leadership or a lapse of whatever it is, the case may be, this guy has been able to kill again, and he's killed his cellmate this past Saturday at Augusta State Medical Prison. His name, the victim is Mr. Eddie Gozer, G-O-S-I-E-R, I believe. He was killed this past Saturday at Augusta State Medical Prison, and, you know, because of the GDC is incompetent, they allowed this individual out of max high max, and he is now he was able to kill again, Susan, and he struck the last Saturday, and, you know, it's just an awful situation because this was a preventable death, and now we see that the GDC has allowed Mr. Gozer to die at the hands of someone that should have never even been in general population.
Absolutely. That's the facts right there.
You know, so that's what we're dealing with this department. You know, they're and like I said, Susan, I want you to touch on as well, leadership starts at the top. And at this point, you know, I don't even know Timothy Ward, and you know, it's almost like, you know, He just needs to step down.
I don't think we'll see that, and we'd better not hold our breath waiting on it. But I completely agree. What's going on? It's a Keystone Cops scenario. And I want to back up for a moment to something regarding staff shortages. You know, the rah-rah go team, thank you so much for all your overtime. This past week, I heard of a single officer who had four dorms, 384 inmates in two different buildings, and he was the only one working. Someone got in touch with me, a different prison, I believe it, where only nine people came to work for that day. If that's the case and you don't have a backup plan, by all means, call Governor Kemp and ask for the National Guard.
They can't do that, because then it would make it look like they've lost control and they can't control anything.
Exactly. I understand it, but it is their job, whether they like it or not. It's their job to keep them
Susan,
safe.
Let me jump in real quick too, because you know I heard just a couple of weeks ago, and for the last month or two before COVID-19, the outbreak of COVID-19 at Wilcox State Prison had one officer, and Wilcox State Prison has two sides. And don't quote me on it, there's an east side and a west side. I do know there's two sides. I don't know if it's east side or west side or north side and east side. But anyway, the point I'm making is they had one officer working three buildings on the east side. This officer was working D building, E building, and I want to say F building. He was working three buildings by himself on a Saturday and Sunday. And from my understanding, this officer was going, he would just open the door and would go to the next building and open the door, and he'd go to the next building and just open the door. And he'd tell everybody if they had a call out or if they were trying to get out, to meet him at the gate, because he let at every building and let them out. You know, so, you know, there goes again. They know they're shorthanded.
Wow.
You know, they know they're shorthanded. They've been shorthanded before this virus outbreak even started taking place. So why come, you know, they're so prideful that they can't step away. They can't use common sense and say, okay, well, you know, we need help. We need to call in the National Guard to help run these prisons and to keep these people safe. See, there goes again. Safety is not their top priority. A human life is not their top priority, and it's sad.
No, I mean, clearly it's not, or this would not happen. Last year, 2019, Department of Corrections in Georgia had 164 inmate deaths. Now, a lot of those were elderly inmates who passed away through the various processes of aging and dying, but others were not. And I'm not sure if I've mentioned it on this show before. There was a group among that 164 inmates. It was a group of men aged 30 to 50 who were listed as having died by natural causes. 30 to 50 died by natural causes. And 40% of them had been convicted of child molestation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't need to love the crime, but in a sense, we do need to love the sinner as far as the protections of the Constitution. It is their job. They are sworn correctional officers, and it is their job, whether they like it or not. It's clear to me, and I'm just an old retired lady, that there's not a respect or an appreciation for life, not the life of an inmate. Mr. Gozier wouldn't be dead. Mr. Mitchell wouldn't be dead. And
all these that has died with the virus wouldn't be dead if they would have done something with these, as you said earlier, with these pre-existing conditions or underlying conditions that they said they had.
I know. It leaves a normal human incredulous that nothing was done. Nothing was done to prevent these people from contracting the virus. My first thought when this happened was they need to stop staff from leaving. I know that sounds ugly. Ooh, you can't go home. You're going to have to live here in a tent or whatever. But that was where it needed to stop then, rather than them going out into the public, going to funerals, to weddings, to whatever was going on, and hugging everybody and coming back to work on Monday at the prison. The inmates were not the ones leaving. The inmates weren't the ones going to Walmart. We know how everybody got sick. It wasn't coming in on a drunk.
No. I wasn't dropped off there in the parking lot and in a drain somewhere or whatnot, you know. And Susan, let me, this wasn't on our agenda either. But let me touch on this contraband thing real quick while we still have a little time. And like I said, stop me if I'm wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but they found this contraband. They took these pictures earlier this week of this confiscated contraband. Now, most facilities has been on lockdown. There's been limited movement besides going to chow and things of that nature. So they found this contraband, but the prisoners know that there's little movement, and they know that it's not very possible that they're going to be able to get out to get this contraband. But they found all this contraband. So how did this contraband get there? And who was supposed to get this contraband to get it into a facility if there's been limited access for moving among the prisoners, and there's been no inmate visitation? How was this supposed to get into these facilities?
Well, you know and I know exactly how it got there.
Yeah, I mean, that was...
Mark.
Yeah, so, you know, I just I want our listeners to, you know, like I said, you can't take them at face value. And even the people that, you know, that just love that department so well and that they're doing an outstanding job, that may be listening to us for the first time or or whatever. I mean, you just can't take the stuff that they release at face value.
You know, I genuinely wish that we could, but as you follow along and read the press releases and weigh what your lying eyes see, it becomes very difficult to take the statements at face value.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. So, Susan, what else is on the schedule, and what else you want to bring to the listeners' attention this morning?
We had talked about the discussing the Eighth Amendment today, and that's the prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment. The enforcement arm of the Eighth Amendment is the Department of Justice, and in the case of prisons, the Civil Rights Division. And again, in the case of prisons, they have their own department called the Special Litigations Section. And that is who does the investigations, opens investigations. When they do investigate, and it is up to the Assistant Attorney General of the Civil Rights Division to make the call on what gets investigated. When they make that decision, they're not playing. They pack a bag, and they come and don't leave for months. On the Wikipedia article about CRIPA, the Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act, it mentions two cases. One is Department of Corrections in Pennsylvania. That case, they investigated for 3 years, and they were investigating really two subjects, solitary confinement and the treatment of mental health inmates. But it was the entire Department of Corrections in Pennsylvania. And that case was resolved when PDC made the changes administratively that they were required to make. The second case that's given on the examples in Wikipedia is the territory of Guam. And I know it's halfway around the world for us. That is still a U.S. territory. The Department of Justice opened an investigation of the prisons in Guam in 1991, and there are still open issues. So the resolution of these investigations can be straightforward if the department being investigated chooses to do the things that they're being asked to do to comply with the Eighth Amendment. But if they dig their heels in, they fight it, they can last a long, long time. And in the case of Guam, decades.
Right. And Susan, at this point, and for the listeners too that may have tuned in, Attorney Deborah Whitlock was supposed to join us today, but she had a last-minute family emergency, so she couldn't join us today. But we're going to hopefully have her back, have her on here in the next coming weeks to kind of go over this in a more in-depth way, because I think it's very important. But me and Deborah actually touched base this week, and you know, she had the information that she was going to share, and I'll share just a little bit with the listeners briefly, and in our closing moments here together this weekend, that you know, the information that she found was very troubling to her on actually seeking and receiving relief, you know, under the Eighth Amendment. You know, she referred to me that the state of Georgia, and you know, not only maybe probably the state of Georgia, but other states, you know, has actually really stacked the deck when it comes to having relief and seeking relief, you know, with the Eighth Amendment, because the state of Georgia, the Department of Corrections, has actually stacked the deck, and you know, it's very, very, very hard to actually seek relief. They either draw it out very, very for a very long period of time, or the judges on the federal level or on the state level, you know, just doesn't have the appetite, you know, to rule against an agency like the Department of Corrections or like a county jail or a federal facility, a prison or a law enforcement facility. That was some of the information that she was going to share with the listeners this morning that, you know, which we pretty much knew, we pretty much know that the deck is stacked when it comes to seeking relief. But there is some cases, which I would believe and would probably, and I will ask Deborah here, like I said, in the next couple of weeks, like Mr. Eddie Gozer, like Mr. Mitchell at Rutledge, where, you know, those cases probably, I would think, would be clear violations of Eighth Amendment protective activity. And I'm not saying that, you know, other cases aren't that, you know, we've talked about, but I would think, and Susan, you can kind of chime in too, and like I said, we'll ask Deborah in the next few weeks, but I would think that those cases like Mr. Gozer and Mr. Mitchell's would be probably clear-cut cases of serious, serious Eighth Amendment violations, and, you know, it probably would have the Department of Corrections probably, you know, wanting to draw some kind of closure on that immediately. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. The saddest part to me about Mr. Gozer is that in 2014, there was an inmate at Augusta State Medical Prison named Shannon Greer who was also killed by mm-hmm. his roommate who
Susan, you're breaking up on me.
Sorry, but it was essentially the same situation at the very same facility.
Yeah, and unfortunately, in that case, there was a cover up in that case. Go ahead.
Well, part of their cover up, I thought it was funny in a sad way, but apparently, Department of Corrections at the Augusta State Medical Prison does not know what county the different dorms are in. That prison site actually sits in two different counties. And part of that was, well, we don't know which county he died in. Are you insane? You don't know what county the different buildings are in? And their official report on that was he died out as a result of an altercation in 2015. Attack. I don't think of that as an altercation.
No, no, and in fairness to the suspect in the Mr. Gozer's death, we do the Department of Corrections is not releasing a name, but we've heard by eyewitness account what happened that Mr. Ferguson was the aggressor, and that Mr. Ferguson, his past record speaks to itself. So we should put that out there for the listeners. He's innocent until proven guilty, and he'll have his day in court. But, you know, it's just a blind oversight and another failure by the Department of Corrections to, their negligence has caused another death of somebody that should be grieving right now. All said and done, the family is planning a funeral for someone that no matter what he did, it doesn't matter. I mean, you know, he still had that right to be protected, and he should have never been in a cell with Mr. Perkins, and Mr. Perkins should have never been in general population. Mr. Ferguson has had incidents like this before where, you know, things happen. So, you know, but Susan, we don't have much time here. Tell us what you're working on. Tell us what you have coming up and anything you want the listeners to know in closing.
I'll give you a little update on They Have No Voice. We are in the process of getting the documents done over this next week to register us with the state as a nonprofit. And once that's done, it opens the door to registering with the IRS and the feds as a nonprofit. I worked yesterday on letters on asking people to serve on the board of directors. I want to do this right, and I want it to be something that's sustainable when Susan Sparks Burns is dead and gone, that They Have No Voice continues, because the inmates will always need a voice. They will in the state of Georgia. And, you know, I can only plead ignorance in the years before my son went to prison. I didn't know what the situation is, how cruel, how unjust, how much wrongdoing, how much contraband, how much violence, gang infiltration into the staff. So many of these issues, I didn't know. And my friends don't know. Even today, they'll say, oh, I thought they had free medical care. Oh, please. people don't know. And it's our job to educate by giving a voice to the inmates. I feel driven to do it, and I want to be surrounded with people who also want to change the status quo with the Department of Corrections. And it needs transparency desperately, desperately. These two deaths this past week were preventable deaths. How many more of them are there?
Yeah. And we know this too, Susan, like I said, because we just now, I mean, there's been deaths the last month and a half that hasn't even been reported. And it's sad when we have to, a group that's not associated with the Department of Corrections has to publicly release deaths to the general public. I mean, it's a sad day when we have to do that. But, you know, with them, you know, they have an image that they're trying to protect because they were caught off guard with the COVID-19, you know, they don't want to lead. They don't want to put bad news on top of bad news, you know. So, but, you know, transparency is definitely needed. And, you know, that's what we're here for. They Have No Voice, Georgia Prison News, Human and Civil Rights Coalition of Georgia, and the very other various group that does good work, you know, working together as Georgia Prison News does and Human Rights Coalition of Georgia and They Have No Voice, you know, we're partnering together. Try to drop that survivability, bring this information to the forefront, because it's important information, you know, and, you know, we give them a voice that they don't have. You know, Susan, and I just want to thank you for your continuous work and tireless efforts, you know, in keeping everybody informed and whatnot. I mean, you do an awesome job, and, you know, it's hopefully we're going to be doing it for a long, long time.
Thank you, Joshua, and thank you again for the opportunity to be with you on this radio show. I hope that our listeners learned some things today, and I know they wouldn't be listening if they weren't interested.
anyone who has a loved one behind the walls or is behind the walls themselves is aware of problems.
Right.
The general public is not aware. So let's span that gap.
Right. And Susan, and I wasn't aware that you told me last week, and, you know, we won't give anybody's name or what facility they're located at or anything like that, so I feel comfortable with saying this, but and I did not know, I think this is the fourth or fifth show that we've
mm-hmm.
done, but, you know, I did not know that there was actually people in prison that listened to this show, which is very encouraging. And what I want to do for next week, Susan, and I'll put it out there for our listeners, for them, for the guys and maybe ladies that are listening right now that's behind the walls, is that, you know, correspond with Susan or myself this week. And, you know, if there's anything that you guys want to make the public aware of for next week's show that you think that needs to be put out there, feel free to contact Susan or myself through Messenger or whatever way that you contact us, and we'll be glad to kind of brainstorm and put the stuff together for next week's show. That way we can get it out there.
I think it's an awesome idea. Please, folks, let us know the topics that are important to you. There's a good chance we have some information and some resources that we can seek information from. To what's otherwise going on in the dark.
Right. All right, Susan. So once again, thank you for another successful show. I think it went great today. I apologize for the beginning. You know, I for some reason couldn't get Facebook Live to work. But we'll play with that this week and see if we can, you know, get that up and running and make it a another way for people to correspond with us throughout the show. So apologize for those, the few technical difficulties. But other than that, it was another successful show this week.
Awesome. Good job, Joshua. I'm so proud to be a part of this.
All right. Well, once again, that was Susan Sparks, and she's been joining us for this hour. Susan, thanks for all your help, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Sounds good. Thank you. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. And you've been listening to the Georgia Prison News weekly radio show. Thanks again for everyone that listened in. Whether it's your first time listening in or you listen to us every week, please share our broadcast. You can go back and listen to it. Please share our broadcast on your various social media platforms, wherever you are, Twitter, Facebook. I'm sure majority is on Facebook, but please share our show with everyone, and you know, if you have any questions, like I said, for show, or you have any upcoming show ideas, or whatever the case may be, please, like I said, get in contact with me through Facebook Messenger or in the Georgia Prison News Facebook group, or you can contact Susan at They Have No Voice, her group, and she'll relay it to me as well. So. Once again, thank you guys for listening to us this morning. I hope you enjoy your Saturday and the rest of your weekend. And we will talk with you guys next week. In the meantime, have a blessed rest of the weekend.